Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, February 2nd. New documents clear up mass shooting timeline. Odessa Police Department releases more than 220 pages of incident reports this past week. The story was written by Caitlin Randall. New documents related to the August 31st mass shooting in Midland and Odessa provide more detail into the shooting that killed 8, including the shooter, and wounded 25. The reports, compiled from 222 pages of incident reports released this past week by the Odessa Police Department through a Freedom of Information request, provide a clearer picture of the route taken by the shooter over the 64 minutes between when he was pulled over in Midland by a state trooper on Interstate 20 and when he was shot by multiple agencies in the parking lot behind Synergy Cinemas in Odessa. Additionally, the reports shed light on the hours before the shooting began. The following is a Reporter Telegram constructed timeline using times, locations, and details compiled from those incident reports. August 31st, 1:29 p.m. OPD officers responded to Journey Oilfield Services on East Murphy Street in Odessa after a manager at the company reported an employee damaged the property. That manager identified the employee as Seth Ator, who he had just fired for mouthing off to other employees at a contracted job site. Ator became irate, the manager told police, and began making accusations that the company was part of a child pornography conspiracy. After Ator attempted to leave without returning his keys to the building, the manager cut off power to a security gate on the perimeter of the lot to prevent Ator from leaving. Instead, Ator drove through the fence, causing several $1,000s worth of damage. Ator began calling 911 while officers were interviewing the manager, and he was transferred to officers at the scene. James Santana was one of the officers who spoke to Ator as he rambled about being held against his will and a cult that was plotting his murder. The phone conversation ended as radio calls came in of a man driving recklessly and holding a long rifle. A description of the driver's vehicle matched Ator's. Officers believed Ator might return to the job site on Murphy. They grabbed their patrol rifles and waited for him to arrive. 3:13 p.m. Department of Public Safety Trooper Chuck Pryor attempted to pull Ator over for failing to signal a lane change on Interstate 20 near Loop 250 in Midland. Ator pointed his rifle through the rearview window of his gold Toyota Camry and shot Pryor. OPD was aware that the vehicle was connected to the earlier disturbance at Journey Oilfield Services. It's unclear if Pryor also knew of the earlier incident when he attempted to stop Ator. Several vehicles and two semi-truck drivers were shot on Interstate 20 between mile markers 131 and 121 as Ator continued west toward Odessa. 3:30 p.m. A driver was shot on the 4500 block of Loop 338 in Odessa, 3 miles from the exit to get onto the loop from Interstate 20. That driver saw Ator's vehicle make a U-turn before heading west onto State Highway 191. Maria Buardo was shot at the intersection of 338 and 191. She had just left Academy Sports and was on the phone with her husband at the time she was shot. He would later tell police he heard screaming before the line went dead. When he called back, a stranger answered the phone and told him his wife and toddler were being taken to the hospital. The toddler was not hurt. Ator was seen on surveillance footage at 3:30 p.m., driving through the parking lot of Freedom Buick GMC off State Highway 191, which turns onto 42nd Street. 15-year-old Layla Hernandez was at the dealership with her mother, brother, and stepfather. They were waiting for a car salesman to bring the keys to a truck for a test drive. Hernandez's stepfather told officers he saw Ator wave at him from his gold Toyota. He started to wave back when Ator pulled out a rifle and began shooting at Hernandez. Her brother was shot, using his body to shield his sister. Her stepfather removed his shirt and held it to the wound in her neck, attempting to stop the bleeding. Paramedics arrived over an hour later at 4:47 p.m. Quote, "The paramedics advised that she was gone and there was nothing they could do for her," an incident report states. They advised that they were going to leave the scene and move on to the next one. Ator is then seen on security footage driving in the middle lane further down 42nd Street past the McDonald's. Several drivers were shot along that stretch of road at Olive Garden, Market Street, and Twin Peaks. 3:34 p.m. A driver was shot at the intersection of 42nd Street and John Ben Shepherd Parkway. He drove away and sheltered in place at a taco stand. Footage from home security cameras captured Ator driving through subdivisions on Tanglewood Lane, Maple Avenue, and East Everglade Avenue. 3:35 p.m. Ator's Toyota is seen on a red light camera at the corner of 38th Street and North Dixie Boulevard. A driver stopped at 36th Street and Dixie saw Ator exit his car with a long black rifle before shooting at the cars in front and behind him. The two cars fled and a yellow dog jumped from Ator's car and ran off. The witness told police Ator then pointed his rifle at her and followed her as she drove away until she turned into an apartment complex off Dixie. At 38th Street and Walnut Avenue, Ator shot and killed Edwin Peregrino. Shell casings were found in the street and carport. Drag marks from the carport to an outside kitchen entrance indicate that Ator drove through Peregrino's driveway. Peregrino was found in his kitchen. Ator stole Mary Granado's U.S. Postal Service van on the 3600 block of Adams Avenue. A witness saw him pull her from the van, shoot her in the head, and again in her side. Surveillance footage captured Ator driving on Adams Avenue and firing sporadically, and a car fleeing after being struck. 3:38 p.m. The white USPS van is captured by security cameras turning into an alleyway on the 3600 block of Walnut Avenue before turning around in the alley and heading south on Walnut. From there, Ator continued 3.5 miles to the corner of Grandview and Yukon Road by Ratliff Stadium. Cameron Brown was found in his company vehicle at that intersection with a single gunshot wound to the head. Ator appears to have continued on Yukon Road before turning onto Faudry Road. Joe Griffith was shot and killed at the stripes on Faudry Road and State Highway 191. His wife and two children were also in the car on the way to have family photos taken. 4:00 p.m. Officers were notified Ator was heading to Synergy Cinemas off State Highway 191. They secured a perimeter around the building and began evacuating patrons into the parking lot. Midland Police Department Officer Zach Owens was canvassing the area behind Synergy after the building was evacuated. He saw a white USPS van and thought it looked suspicious. As he approached the vehicle, Ator began shooting at him. He saw the van leave the scene and travel west on Dr. Emmett Headley Street before turning around and heading back toward Synergy. 4:17 p.m. The USPS van crashed into OPD and MPD patrol vehicles in the parking lot behind Synergy. There was extensive damage to the front of the van, and the side airbags were deployed. Ator shot at officers before he crashed, including at Santana. Officers fired at least 16 shots into Ator, according to his autopsy report, before pulling him from the vehicle and handcuffing him. An autopsy indicated Ator was pronounced dead at 6:31 p.m. at Synergy. An AR rifle and pistol were recovered from the scene. Four 30-round magazine cartridges were later recovered from the abandoned Toyota, along with a set of keys on a Batman key ring. 10:35 p.m. An employee from the Utah Fusion Center at Salt Lake City contacted the OPD the night of August 31st. He said his job is to forward threats the FBI receives to local law enforcement. He said the FBI notified him about a video at TikTok from a man with the username MR70000. In the video, a man matching Ator's description was seen singing a song and making actions to the song that described driving around and killing people. The man used the hashtag #OdessaCheck in the video's caption. Census to put official numbers on Midland's growth. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. The population inside Midland County was estimated at 173,576 in 2017, and it was thought that Hispanics would make up 52% of the population in 2020. That is what the U.S. Census Bureau is estimating this census year, said Bureau Senior Partnership Specialist Charlene Romero McBride. Quote, I think that is 20,000 short, McBride said of the total population. She told the Midland Republican National Hispanic Assembly last week that she expects Hispanics will make up 58% of the population. McBride, who is involved in the effort to count population in 13 counties in West Texas, said the number one goal is to ensure an accurate count, no matter the population or demography outcome. Quote, where you live, 51% of the time is where you are counted, McBride said. Last year, the U.S. Census Bureau estimated Midland's growth from 2010 to 2018 was 25.9%. That ranked Midland's metropolitan area as the fourth fastest-growing community in the nation. McBride told those in attendance that the U.S. Constitution requires the counting of every resident and that the census matters because it is used in the drawing of congressional and state legislative districts, in the distribution of $675 billion annually, and in the planning for government, businesses, and nonprofits. McBride said that for the first time, residents will be able to use the Internet to participate in the once-a-decade count. Online is one of four ways to respond, she said. The other are by phone, by mail, or in person. She also said that an educational campaign is underway to change the mindset of those who might not want to participate in the census process. She said a study of barriers, attitudes, and motivators showed there were issues with apathy and efficacy, privacy concerns, fear of repercussions, distrust in government, and few perceived personal benefits. She said the process has been slimmed down to 9 questions and information is kept confidential. The Census Bureau states it will never even share a respondent's personal information with other government agencies, and wrongful disclosure can result in prison time and/or a fine. Quote, "We're not talking about taking people away from our communities," McBride said. The census process is set to move from its promotion phase to its motivation action phase, also described as a call to action for residents to respond. The motivation action phase is expected to last from February through June. In March, the self-response part of the collection process will start. Non-response follow-ups will begin in May. The data collection is expected to be completed in August, according to the Census Bureau. Midland County demographics. 2010 population, 138,000. 2017 estimated population, 173,000. 2010 Hispanic population, 45.3%. 2020 Hispanic population estimate, 52%. Source, U.S. Census Bureau. Did you know? The first census started in 1790. It took 2.5 years to complete, and U.S. Marshals conducted the count, according to Charlene Romero McBride, Senior Partnership Specialist for the Census Bureau. Jobs are available in the 2020 census collection process. Applicants must be at least 18. Salary is up to $24.50 an hour, and mileage is paid at a rate of 58 cents a mile. To apply, go to 2020census.gov/jobs. Emergency management reports 1 dies in fire in West Midland County. 1 person died Friday in a fire that took place in western Midland County, according to the Midland County Emergency Management Office. A press release stated emergency responders fought a structure fire in the 10,300 block of West County Road 56 for several hours. After the fire was extinguished, investigators with the Midland County Fire Marshal's Office located the deceased remains of the only occupant of the residence, 60-year-old Mitchell Martin of Midland, according to the press release. An investigation revealed the fire, which was reported around 6 p.m., was accidental in nature, according to the Midland County Emergency Management Office. Working with emergency responders were local volunteer fire departments and a private sector water transport company. The Midland County Fire Marshal's Office recommends all residents make and practice a fire plan with their families. The plan should include a minimum of 2 exits and that all exits are clear of debris and clutter. Also, fire and smoke alarms should be installed and maintained. Residents with questions or concerns regarding fire safety can call the Fire Marshal's Office at 688-4160. Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Monday, February 3rd. Nuclear waste storage could continue in Carlsbad. DOE seeks to renew permit for waste isolation pilot plant. The story was written by Adrian Hedden of the Carlsbad Current Argus newspaper. Nuclear waste could continue to be buried beneath Carlsbad for another 32 years if the New Mexico Environment Department approves a permit renewal filed for the waste isolation pilot plant by the U.S. Department of Energy and contractor Nuclear Waste Partnership. The 10-year renewal did not entail any changes to the process of accepting transuranic waste, mostly radiated clothing items or machine parts, or emplacing it in the underground salt formations about 2,000 feet below the surface. It did not seek to increase WIP's capacity or make changes to three areas permitted to hold waste: a parking area where waste is held before being brought into the WIP, the waste handling building within the facility, and the underground salt mine where it is permanently disposed. The renewal application did seek to alter the final date of emplacement, as defined in the permit, from 2024 to 2052, adding 28 years to WIP lifetime. Karen Day, a permitting manager with NWP, said the contractor and DOE would file subsequent permit modification requests as more space is needed. She presented the renewal application to public stakeholders during a Thursday meeting at the DOE's Skeen Whitlock Building in Carlsbad. It was the second public hearing on the matter, with the first held January 23rd in Santa Fe. Representatives from the City of Carlsbad and other local agencies spoke in support of the renewal. No opposition was voiced during the meeting. WIP holds TRU waste in 8 panels, with waste being emplaced in Panel 7 as Panel 8 is being mined. Panel 8 was expected to be fully mined by 2020. Mining of Panel 8 started in 2013, but was interrupted after an accidental radiological release in the underground due to an improperly packaged drum of waste led to a 3-year halt of WIP's primary operations. The south end of the mine was recently closed, allowing no more waste to be added to the area after a rock fall. By the year 2024, Day said that WIP would be accepting 17 shipments per week with 40 shipping weeks each year. Quote, "The assumption is that future panels will be needed. The permittees will request additional permit modifications in the future for those additional panels," Day said. Continuing the quote, "The permittees are proposing no changes to the permitted units. They have indicated that there are no significant changes in this renewal application," end quote. At the meeting, Carlsbad Mayor Dale Janway touted the economic benefit he said WIP brought to Carlsbad since it opened in 1999. He said the city supported the renewal and WIP's role in national defense. Quote, "WIP provides stable, good-paying jobs," Janway said. "We also believe it is vitally important to keep this process moving along. There's still tens of thousands of cubic meters of waste that will need to be sent to WIP for several decades. WIP is a modernized facility that should serve the nation for as long as is needed. We're proud of the important role we play in national security," end quote. Norbert Rempe, a retired geologist and former WIP employee, questioned the permit renewal as providing no plan for where waste would be emplaced after Panel 7 and 8 are filled. Quote, "It is my understanding that this renewal application is looking forward, not backward. When the first permit was received from the state, we had a picture similar to this one," he said, while indicating a map of the WIP underground displayed during the meeting. "Now we want to extend it until 2052, and we have no picture of what is going to happen. The public has no idea what is to happen in the next 10 years or 32. If WIP is saying it is communicating with the public on what will happen in the future, then this is insufficient," end quote. Larry Mitchell, vice president of the Carlsbad Department of Development's Board of Directors, said the final emplacement date was arbitrary and extending it was a mere technicality, as TRU waste was continually being generated during nuclear research and other activities. He said WIP should continue to be used to dispose of TRU waste for as long as needed. Quote, "Our community knows that this date was always arbitrary," Mitchell said. "There is TRU waste being generated that should go to WIP. It makes sense to put a proven facility that has been modernized and has a highly trained workforce to good use," end quote. Mitchell warned that if WIP activities were ceased in the coming years, nuclear waste could build up at generator sites, often near high population areas or bodies of water. Quote, "I assumed those that live near the generators in northern New Mexico would certainly agree with this logic rather than allowing TRU waste to be stockpiled," Mitchell said. "We know that WIP continues to responsively serve as a permanent solution to the nation's TRU waste created by the nation's defense programs. We believe it would be foolish to set an arbitrary date limit," end quote. Scott Kovac, Operations and Research Director at Nuclear Watch New Mexico, a Santa Fe-based nuclear watchdog group, argued that the public agreed to a specific amount of waste and a time limit on operations before WIP was opened. He cautioned that national laboratories would soon begin increasing plutonium pit production, which could result in more TRU waste being generated, and request to extend WIP operations even beyond 2052. Quote, "It's very likely that it could go on much longer than that," Kovac said. "The extension of the date needs to be discussed thoroughly. We need to slow down and look at what the implications could be," end quote. Kovac said the DOE should be figuring out what to do with TRU waste after WIP is closed, and that the need for more time to emplace the waste in the permitted space was due to inefficient packing during past operations. Quote, "We'd feel a lot better if they were working on what happens after WIP," he said. "That doesn't seem to come up. They were very inefficient in emplacing the waste. Because of DOE's inefficiency, New Mexico is getting straddled with a longer opening of WIP," end quote. If WIP is kept open longer, Kovac worried it could become a repository for more than low-level TRU waste. Quote, "WIP is the only real hole in the ground for radioactive waste," he said. "The longer it stays open, the more chances are they'll try to bring more types of waste," end quote. Chance of snow is forecast. A cold spell this week is likely to bring snow to the area, according to the National Weather Service. The National Weather Service's seven-day forecast is showing a cold front is expected to move into the area this week, with low temperatures dropping into the 20s Tuesday and Wednesday nights. The forecast for Tuesday night calls for rain showers before 9 p.m., and then rain and snow showers are likely. The chance of snow showers continues into Wednesday morning, and then a chance of rain and snow showers is in the forecast Wednesday, when the high temperature is expected to top off at 38 degrees. The National Weather Service is calling for a 70% chance of precipitation on Tuesday night and a 30% chance on Wednesday. The National Weather Service reported a trace amount of snow on January 11th. The last time the National Weather Service showed snow accumulation more than a trace was December 8, 2016, when 0.3 inches was recorded. The last time 1 inch or more accumulated at Midland International was December 27, 2015, 7.6 inches. Temperatures are expected to warm up into the 50s on Thursday and into the 60s by Friday and Saturday. National Weather Service reports January was fifth warmest in city's history. January 2020 was the fifth warmest January in Midland's recorded history, according to the National Weather Service. The January recap from the NWS shows an average temperature of 48.9 degrees, which is 5 degrees above average for the month. January 2020 also was the warmest January going back to 2006. The warmest first month of the year in Midland was in 1953, 52.1 degree average. The warm start to the year means 2020 is picking up where 2019 and most of the entire decade of the 2010s left off. The National Weather Service previously reported that the average temperature during the previous decade was more than 1.5 degrees higher than the previous record. The National Weather Service also reported that 6 of the 8 warmest years on record at Midland International were between 2010 and 2019, including the final 4 years, 2016 through 2019, that were all among the warmest 8. The average temperature in 2019 in Midland was the 8th warmest in recorded history. The Climate Prediction Center showed a break for the region in terms of above-average temperatures in February. The CPC is calling for average temperatures this month. Over the next 3 months, the CPC is calling for a 50% chance of above-average temperatures and 30% chance of below-average rain. The National Weather Service reported 67 hundredths of an inch of rain in January, which was 11 hundredths of an inch greater than average. The warmest Januaries in Midland, 1953, 52.1 degrees, 1952, 51.3 degrees, 1950, 50.4 degrees, 2006, 49.3 degrees, 2020, 48.9 degrees. Doctor says to feel safe, people need to know they're important. Midland Independent School District hosts 5th Annual Mental Health Conference. The story was written by Caitlin Randall. Midland ISD hosted its 5th Annual Mental Health Conference on Friday for school counselors, educators, and others who work with children. This year's conference centered around the polyvagal theory, which focuses on how the nervous system connects to social engagement, said Joelle Bracken, MISD's Student Behavioral Support Coordinator. Quote, "It's really interesting and it's really helpful," she said. "So we thought it would be helpful to our counselors," end quote. Dr. George Thompson was the keynote speaker at this year's event. Thompson is an expert in polyvagal theory and chief medical officer of a child behavioral health agency in Kansas City. He spoke about the 3 different states of the brain, which he described as safety, danger, and life threat. He says a person needs to feel safe for their brain to work properly and for them to display correct behaviors. Quote, "A nervous system that's focused on danger can't focus on solutions," he said. "It first needs to know that it's safe," end quote. Thompson said the main way counselors and educators can make patients and students feel safe is by demonstrating that they care about the other's experiences. They can do this by showing patients or students that they're important, he said. He also spoke about children in the community who might be traumatized after the August shootings in Midland and Odessa. Quote, "If a dangerous thing happens to a group of people, we have to be more deliberate about connecting," he said. "To help people heal from trauma, they must see that their experience matters and they're not alone in their experience," he said. The rise of technology presents a challenge for those who work with children, he said. He said people are often disconnected from face-to-face communication, but face-to-face communication is what conveys signals of safety to others. After the keynote speech, there were training sessions on topics such as connecting with others, improving marriages, and working with children who have experienced traumas, Bracken said. She said one goal of the conference was to connect different service providers in the area who may need to collaborate in the future. Quote, "Sometimes it takes more than one agency to best serve a student or a family," she said. "So we want those people meeting each other so that they can connect," end quote. The other goal, Bracken said, is to keep counselors current with what they've been trained in. Quote, "This field is constantly changing, so our counselors need to be up to date on their skills and their knowledge so they can best serve kids," she said.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Sunday, February 2nd, 2020. This is the section called Viewpoints, Section B. The article is entitled, "Clock is Ticking for Midland County Hospital District's Sales Tax Campaign," by Stuart Doreen. Midland County Hospital District officials ran a bond campaign in 2009 with the slogan that asked the voter, "How good of a facility do you want when you need health care?" The end result was the passage of the first $100 million bond in Midland, and the election wasn't close. Campaign officials earned a 28-plus point victory in what might be considered the most technically superior campaign in the last two decades. Roz Grover put together a plan, satisfied potential doubters, and the rest was electoral history. Now, 11 years later, the hospital district has decided to come before Midland County voters again with hat in hand. MCHD officials likely are to frame the debate in a similar manner. When those doors of the much nicer Scarborough Tower open, how good do you want the care to be? Because no matter what you think of how Midland Memorial got into this financial situation, whether the extra quarter cent in sales tax would be better used for another priority in the community, or what you think of the health care offered at Midland Memorial, none of that matters. Trustees will frame this election not as a referendum about what MMH is, but what healthcare in this community could become. And that allows for two choices. The first is that voters pass a quarter cent increase in the sales tax in both the city and county. That money would help make up for expected losses in reduced federal funding over at least the next 5 years. The second is that voters thumb their noses at a tax hike. The hospital board can't raise property taxes enough to make up the money needed for community health care services, Texas Tech University Health Science Center, mental health entities, and some funding for emergency room staffing. In fiscal year 2019, that number was $40.147 million. MCHD officials said a no vote means there would be a decline in health care providers and the quality and the number of doctors in a community that can't afford it. Hospital officials make this claim of potential doctor shortages because compensation is paid to more than 200 physicians, 75% of those on the active medical staff, through community health care services, using federal funds that are expected to decline by around 80% in the next 4 years. Hospital district officials said this will be the crux of their campaign. Some version of "Say Yes to Better Healthcare" will be the mantra when campaigning takes place over the next few months. And while there are 78 days between now and the start of early voting, officials expect to reach the most people after March 3rd, the date of the primary elections in Texas. That will mean a 48-day sprint from the end of one election to the opening of another. That period includes spring break. Hospital district officials told the Reporter Telegram their polling shows there will be a significant climb ahead to earn that extra quarter cent in sales tax. But these campaigns shouldn't be easy. Midlanders need to be convinced when their tax dollars are on the line. I don't think there are any similarities between this election and the recent school bond election. Midland ISD proposed raising property taxes. The hospital district seeks a sales tax increase. The school district's board was high profile. Even the most connected Midlander likely doesn't know his or her hospital board representative. The school board can be found at the top of a person's tax bill. The hospital board's is closer to the bottom, and its rate is a fraction of MISD's. There are a lot of electoral advantages for Midland County Hospital District, but it's a tax, and even sales tax elections require the ability to convince a skeptical electorate. The clock is ticking for MCHD to make its case. This is the obituary column, Sunday, February 2nd, 2020. Charles Miller. Charles Miller, 92, of Midland, passed away on Tuesday, January 28, 2020. He was born April 26, 1927, in Birmingham, Pennsylvania, to the late Charles Miller and Helen Lavina Calderwood Miller. He is preceded in death by his parents, Charles and Helen, and a grandson, Brenton Rader. Charlie is survived by his wife, Catherine, son Tim and wife Lupe of Dallas, Texas, daughter Sally and husband Doug of Glendale, Arizona, four grandchildren, and three great-grandchildren. He is also survived by his only sister, Susan Noel, two nieces, and grandnieces and grandnephews, all from Tyrone, Pennsylvania. No public services are scheduled. Please visit ellisfuneralhomes.com to leave online condolences. This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Sunday, February 2nd, 2020. This is the section, Letters to the Editor. New District 2 rep says thank you. I can't tell you how honored and grateful I am to have been elected to represent the residents of District 2. On behalf of my incredible wife, Denise, and myself, I want to thank the residents of District 2 for the faith and confidence you have vested in me. While I am proud of the campaign we ran, we can all be proud of the campaigns run by Adrian Urquidy and Stephen Viella. They, too, had Midland's best interest at heart. I want to thank them for stepping up. To my new colleagues on the Midland City Council, I am looking forward to working with each of you. I believe we have a great opportunity to invest in Midland's future in spite of the ups and downs of the oil and gas industry. And by doing so, we protect ourselves from the downsides of rapid growth like housing shortages, while enjoying the upsides like better jobs and higher wages. To the residents of District 2, I am proud to announce that in the coming days, I will be looking for two volunteers from each precinct in District 2 to serve on the District 2 Advisory Committee. This committee will help me represent you in the most transparent way possible. Thank you again for the honor and opportunity to serve. Signed, John Norman, Council Member Elect. System-wide intercom failure is inexcusable. Midland ISD has very poor administrators who do not know how to manage building upkeep. The recent lockdown at Midland High School is evidence of that. There should be no excuse for a system-wide intercom failure. News reports state that the system is old and in disrepair. Apparently, our administrators don't know what upkeep and maintenance are. Maintenance is neglected, as is quite evident throughout all school campuses. I believe what is now going to become common is it is old and we need to update by passing a multi-million-dollar school bond so this won't happen again. A new, simple system, such as a general quarters via loudspeakers, such as employed on Navy ships, would be a loud and clear signal to all to man your station until further notice, until all clear is given. Even a loud siren to give warning of lockdown is happening would be easy to install, and costly rewiring dollars would be saved. A system like this is best because it could be heard over 100% of the school campus, from classrooms to outside grounds. All persons would hear the distress warning. Such a system would even thwart the very person or persons who would cause harm to our students, because police would also hear and respond. Signed, Robert LaFarrell. Candidate Letters. 142nd District Court Judge. Baker has professionalism experience. Did you know that the 142nd District Court hears both civil and criminal cases? Mary Baker is the right choice for judge of the 142nd District Court because of her experience. She has worked with and been mentored by some of Midland's finest judges. Early in her career, she was a briefing attorney for Judge Robert Junell and handled many complex criminal cases as part of his team. After this, she began practicing civil law and was partner in her firm by age 30. Mary is a Life Fellow of the Texas Bar Association, has received recognition from the Pro Bono College of the State Bar of Texas, is a top woman attorney in Texas, and was selected by her peers as a Texas Super Lawyer's Rising Star in Energy Law for 2018 to 2020. Due to her hard work litigating cases for business and oil and gas clients, this professionalism and experience with both criminal and civil cases is what separates Mary Baker from her competition. Mary Baker is the right lawyer to be the judge for the 142nd District Court. I encourage you to support Mary Baker for judge. Signed, Lori Wesley. Rogers has brilliant legal mind. I cannot imagine a better candidate for 142nd District Court judge than David Rogers. His breadth of legal knowledge is awe-inspiring and something I hope to emulate in my legal career. I practiced law in Midland for 5 years and saw firsthand how incredibly patient and kind David is, while also a force to be reckoned with. To be honest, I was intimidated when I first met David. He has such a great reputation, is well known for his intelligence and how he vigorously advocates for his clients. However, I had nothing to worry about. I cannot think of a more humble and gracious individual, both professionally and personally. David never hesitated to offer help and was always willing to give guidance despite his incredibly busy schedule. He also never asked for anything in return, which speaks volumes about his character. I consider myself lucky and truly blessed to have been able to work with David. I believe the residents of Midland will also feel the same way if David is elected, and I strongly encourage them to vote for him in the primaries. Midland will not only gain a brilliant mind, but a fair and impartial judge. Signed, Danielle Parkinson, Dallas. Baker enjoys helping people. I could mention accolades, achievements, and knowledge Mary Baker has that more than qualifies her for judge. It's all been listed before. Many may have qualifications, but sometimes qualifications are just that, qualifications. The kind of person one is speaks volumes. We tend to hold a judge to a higher standard. We expect them to be honest, fair, and care about people. In today's world, that is hard to find. So I want to touch on Mary, the person. She exemplifies all the things we expect to find in a judge. She has a servant heart, genuinely wants to help people, and is genuine in all that she does. There are quite a few children in our community looking for a forever home. Without lots of publicity or accolades, generally at minimal payment, Mary has been quietly assisting families with adoptions and helping form forever families. She doesn't do it for adoration or kudos. She does it simply because she cares about others and truly enjoys helping people. She has no idea the impact she has on these families. I am honored to say that Mary was instrumental in completing my forever family. I vote Mary Baker for 142nd District Court Judge. Signed, Jana Huff. Baker gives of her time, talent. Mary Baker is the best choice for judge of the 142nd District Court. Not only does she have experience in both civil and criminal law, but she is also a considerate person who gives of her time, talent, and treasure to better our community. Mary is known for her work with nonprofits, serving on several boards including the United Way, the Junior League of Midland, and the Museum of the Southwest. She is also very active in her church. Besides her professional accomplishments, I believe her charitable contributions show that she truly cares about our community and being a servant leader. Because of her numerous personal contributions to our community, Mary was recognized as one of Midland's inaugural 20 Under 40 in 2016 and a Girl Scout of the Southwest Women of Distinction in 2018. I'm voting for Mary Baker for judge because I want someone who is genuine and who truly loves and cares for our community. I know Mary Baker wants the best for every person in our community, that she will be a fair and impartial judge, and that she has the experience necessary to do the job well. Join me and vote Mary Baker. Signed, Jamie Alexander. County Commissioner, Precinct 1. Ramsey represents conservative values. As a native Midlander, I returned home in 2001 to build my career and raise my family. I found a home at Ramsey Petroleum, which I am forever grateful. County Commissioner Scott Ramsey has been a mentor of mine for the last 8 years. He trained me professionally as a landman, where I learned firsthand his conservative business principles and integrity. He taught me his methodical decision-making process and how to treat people with respect. He instilled a West Texas work ethic in me and the other landmen he trained. Vote to re-elect Commissioner Scott Ramsey to continue to have a person with a solid business background who represents conservative values when handling our tax dollars. Mr. Ramsey has a true passion to build his community and the county he calls home. His work ethic and decision-making can always be trusted. He always had my back. I know he has your back as well. Signed, Chris Aragai. Ramsey will keep property taxes low. Growing up in Midland, it was hard to picture myself coming back to my hometown to live out my adult years. I saw myself one day owning a high-rise apartment in bustling New York City or a modern four-bedroom with an infinity pool in Malibu. Scaling back as I started to get older, I then saw myself buying a home in Austin, where I had been living. That is, until I became a real adult and realized that even in Austin, the property tax rates nearly cancel out the luxury of homeownership for a single 30-year-old. Enter tax-slashing hero, our Midland County Precinct 1 Commissioner, Scott Ramsey. Scott has not only lowered property taxes every year since taking office, but he also continues fighting to keep it that way. I am proud to say that I am a new homeowner in Midland. On top of the financial subsidy of lowered taxes, Scott's conservative principles and values have also made me feel much more at home again. And as a candidate with a strong business background, Scott's the one will continue keeping our county's budget fiscally stable and our taxes as low as possible. Signed, Carolyn Atchison. Letters policy. There is a 350-word limit. Candidate letters have a 200-word limit. Letters must be submitted to letters@mrt.com. Deadline is noon Thursdays for the following Sunday. Report a telegram policy limits individuals to one letter in a 30-day period. Letter writers should include phone number and address. Failure to do so could delay letters publication. This article is entitled Planning Now for Spring Break Can Make for More Pleasant Trip by the Permian Basin Better Business Bureau. Spring break offers an opportunity to travel with your family while the kids get a vacation from school. While it may be still a few months away, now is the time to start planning your spring break travels and activities. When planning trips, it is important to be on the lookout for travel scams and complaint-worthy travel agencies. More than 400 Texas consumers filed complaints with the Better Business Bureau against travel agencies in 2019, with issues ranging from advertising to contracts and guarantees. Nearly 24 travel and vacation scams were reported in the state to Better Business Bureau Scam Tracker last year as well, with some consumers claiming losses of hundreds of dollars. Travel scammers may use stolen photos of luxury hotels, resorts, or rentals, advertising them at unbelievable prices. Once you make your payment, they take your money and you discover the place never existed. Other scammers create fraudulent third-party booking sites for hotels or airline tickets, taking your credit card information and canceling your reservation shortly after. Use these tips from your Better Business Bureau as you plan your spring break travels. Look for reviews. Check BBB.org and other online reviews when considering a hotel, resort, or travel agency. You can also call and ask for references, but watch for vague answers. Also, be wary of companies that don't provide any photos. Don't wire money. Avoid using wire transfer or prepaid debit cards to pay for your vacation, as you can't get the money back if you get scammed. Consider using a credit card so you can dispute the charges if something goes wrong. Be realistic. If an offer is too good to be true, it probably is. Do your research and get a feel for what similar hotels, airlines, or travel agencies are charging. Check social media. Most travel destinations have a social media presence. Check their pages for photos, looking at the quality. If the photos are pixelated or captions are full of typos, this may be a sign of a page run by a scammer. You can also check the comment sections for reviews. For more information, contact Heather Massey, Senior Regional Director for the Permian Basin Office of Better Business Bureau, at 741-2592 or hmassey@permianbasin.bbb.org. This article is entitled Gas Prices: Drivers in Midland, Odessa Are Paying the Most by Stuart Doreen. The highest average prices for gas in the state of Texas are back in the Permian Basin. AAA Texas reported this week that the price of gasoline dropped 9 cents in El Paso, meaning Midland and Odessa were the locations where drivers are paying the most for gasoline. Drivers were paying $2.49 a gallon for regular unleaded in Midland and $2.46 in Odessa. El Paso came into the week with an average of $2.51, but AAA Texas reported an average of $2.42 on Thursday. The organization surveys 27 of the largest metropolitan areas weekly. Drivers in Sherman, Denison, which is located northeast of the Metroplex, are paying $2.13 a gallon. Not only are drivers in Midland, Odessa paying, on average, at least 20 cents more than the state average, but the price in the area is higher than in other West Texas cities. San Angelo's average of $2.31 is the closest to the average in Midland, Odessa. AAA Texas reported an average of $2.21 in Amarillo, $2.22 in Lubbock, and $2.24 in Abilene, where the price dropped 9 cents week over week. Distributors have told the Reporter-Telegram there are many complexities in the fuel business that impact pricing. They point to the high cost of transportation from Gulf Coast refineries and Midland's distance from pipelines. There are also issues with the high cost of living, at least in Midland and Odessa, where rents have climbed at rates incomparable around the state. AAA Texas stated in its weekly report that despite crude oil price fluctuation and growing geopolitical concerns with Iran in recent weeks, gas price averages across the country are falling. Increasing gasoline supplies continue to help put downward pressure on pump prices, AAA Texas spokesman Daniel Armbruster stated. As long as supplies remain healthy and demand for gas is low, drivers should continue to see lower pump prices. According to the Energy Information Administration's latest report, total gasoline stocks in the region grew by just more than 1 million barrels to 32.65 million barrels week to week. The current supply level is nearly 2 million barrels higher than last year's level at this time, which will likely continue to help prices in the region decline throughout the week. Drivers in Midland paid an average of $2.43 for gas 1 year ago. That also was the highest price in the state and 33 cents higher than the state average at that time.
That's the end of the first hour of the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American. We'll begin our second hour right after we take a look at weather.